chief Washington commentator for the Financial Times. He joined us in Washington about 4 years ago. I think his first days on the job were here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. And he came to us from London, actually from The Economist, where he had been for 20 plus years, finishing out there as deputy editor. He was educated at Oxford and LSE and worked in Her Majesty's Treasury. He's also, in his spare time, a semi-professional landscape photographer, so he enjoys being out here in Aspen for that reason as well. So thank you all for being here, and I'll turn it over to you, Clyde.
Thanks. Well, thank you for coming. You're going to watch us struggle with this slightly strange format, I think. It puts the term inner circle in a whole new light, doesn't it? We have a terrific topical subject to be discussing, the future of financial regulation. There's so much going on in this sphere at the moment. And we have a panel to discuss it of remarkable quality and quantity. So let me introduce the panel. Beth Brooke is the head of public policy at Ernst & Young, a member of that firm's global management committee. She has many other achievements and distinctions to her name, but I'm going to keep these introductions brief, then we can start. Dean Baker is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in DC, and the scourge of sloppy economic journalism on his blog, Beat the Press. Bob Steele is a director of Wells Fargo, former Undersecretary of the Treasury for Domestic Finance, and chairman of the board of the Aspen Institute. Roger Ferguson, president and CEO of TIAA-CREF, a member of the President's Economic Recovery Advisory Board. Tom Wilson, president and CEO of the Allstate Corporation. Peter Wallison is a scholar. He holds the chair of financial policy studies at AEI, a distinguished commentator of many years standing on these issues. To get the ball rolling, I thought I'd turn first to you, Bob, and ask you for an overview, a comment, really, on Obama's financial regulation proposal. My reason for putting that to you first, Bob, as you probably know, was one of the principal architects of Paulson's financial regulation blueprint in the last year of the Bush administration. What Obama is proposing has things in common, I think, with what Paulson proposed, but in other respects is quite different. So I wondered if you could give us your take, really just give us your reaction on the plan and how you think it measures up.
Sure, thank you. First of all, I think there's a bit of stage setting, if I might, that we have in this country a framework for all financial services that is really 70 years old. And basically, our regulatory structure has been built block by block on top of foundations that were from the 1930s. And so we need a lot of attention. That's why Secretary Paulson felt that we should attack this, and that's why I believe that President Obama's team has too. So with that said, first of all, this is very challenging. It's very hard work, and it attracts lots of special interests. And President Obama and his team should be lauded for taking this on as an early priority to my mind. And I think in general they've got the right main ideas of focusing on overall stability to the system, focused on investor protection, and focused on what we call prudential regulation, or the regulation of the specific institutions. And while some of the thrusts are correct, I feel like in some ways they have not gone as far as they should. This is a very special moment. I think the odds of getting the public enthusiasm as focused on these needs ever again in my lifetime, I hope, won't happen. So we shouldn't miss this opportunity to do as much as we can. The three hard issues, I think, are systemic risk. I think that the whole idea of when to engage with important institutions and investor protection. Where I think they haven't gone far enough, there's some very specific things, and we can discuss them here. Secretary Paulson thought we should combine the CFT and the SEC. We're probably the only major country in the world that really separates futures, stocks, options, and things like this, and I think they basically pulled the punch on this, and they should have done that. Two, it doesn't address GSEs as to how they should be undone or dealt with, and I think that's a mistake.
Maybe just explain that.
That Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the whole housing issue, they don't attack that issue. And I guess really the last issue that I think they should have been more forthcoming about is the idea of consolidating the different prudential regulators. That we now have banks are supervised in many cases by, they choose 5, 6, 7 different people. And I think an important plank to an improved plan would be consolidation of regulators under just one or two key regulators. I'll stop there.
Maybe we just go around the group, and I'd be interested to hear other people's reactions to what you said and their own reactions to the plan. Dean, let's start with you.
Well, I'd agree with much of what you said. I would agree particularly that the regulations didn't go far enough, and just one area that I would harp on is the issue of derivative instruments. I really would like to see derivative instruments exchange-traded and as much as possible get rid of the non-standardized derivative instruments, which make a very unpleasant environment. But my major critique, I think that the issue, the problem that we face is not so much a problem that we had the wrong regulations. We did. But the real problem was we had failed regulators. And I'm really concerned that we're letting our regulators off the hook. And again, the lesson here, this was an entirely foreseeable disaster. We had an $8 trillion housing bubble. If you weren't asleep, if you were a regulator, if you were Alan Greenspan at the Fed, you were awake, you should have seen an $8 trillion housing bubble. You should have known that when an $8 trillion housing bubble collapses, it's going to sink the economy and throw it into a really bad downturn. That was really fundamental. If you could make an error of that magnitude and still hang on to your job, now I know Greenspan's gone, but Bernanke was in on this. He was at the Fed before he left to be at the Council of Economic Advisors. If you could make an error of that magnitude and suffer no consequences for your career, what are we telling regulators for the future? What's the structure of incentives? We have to understand it's always going to be a problem if you're a regulator to go to the financial industry and say you can't do what you're making lots of money on. That's always going to be hard for a regulator. So if you could get away with that, you don't do anything where you should and suffer no consequences, it's hard to imagine a worse disaster than what we're looking at now, then the message we're telling regulators in the future is just go along. And I think we're setting ourselves up for disasters in the future if we don't hold our regulators accountable. And to date, none of them have been held accountable.
Yeah, I think Dean's making a really important point that gets lost often. And let me give you an example first. We had a problem in one of our states where we weren't settling our claims right. And so we got sued, and we had to pay money to do that, which was fair because we did it wrong. 2 years later, I'm in the same room, same meeting, same people, and we're getting sued again, and they tell me we're going to have to settle. And I said, why did this happen? Well, the lawyers had too complicated a thing. The claim people did something else. They were all wrong. If I only blamed the lawyers as we went forward, I wouldn't have gotten the kind of solution that I want now, which is hopefully we'll never make this mistake again. I think today, the financial services industry, and as one of its executives, we made a lot of mistakes. I lost $1.7 billion for our shareholders last year. I'm not happy about that. But I made some mistakes. But there are a lot of other people who made mistakes as well, and you're not hearing that story. And unless you hear that story, whatever the solution is won't be right. Because if you only blame one party, and so there's a study that's supposed to look at this, what happened. It's due in 2010, conveniently, because there are a bunch of Congress people who are well behind Fannie and Freddie and said, let's roll the dice, let's expand it, let's do high subprime loans. There are regulators who weren't paying attention. And so nobody's really told the story yet. And until we tell the story, we're not going to get a good solution.
Well, I think that commission is really interesting that Tom mentions. It's due to report out in 2010 because this legislation will likely move through Congress in 2009, and then you'll get a commission that sort of analyzes what went wrong. Yeah. So that seems a little bit out of sequence. But to Dean's point, I mean, I agree with Bob that I was underwhelmed with the proposals. Thought they would go further, wondered if they weren't leaving some room for Congress to put its fingerprints on the proposals and therefore stopped a little short. Don't know. I know I was approached by the media the night the proposals came out, and because I was underwhelmed, and I shared that sort of off the record. And they said, well, would you go on the record? And I said, well, no, because part of this is about restoring confidence. So to come out and say, you know, you were a little underwhelmed, that's not a great thing to do. You need to be supportive at this point. The thing, though, that I do think is important is this isn't just a national solution that we're focused on. The president's proposals were focused on the United States, obviously, but
The problem was not contained within a country boundary. It was not contained within an institution's boundary. The transactions that were entered into and failures abound all around were global. And the solution is going to have to be global. And I think that that's going to be an important thing. The EU came out with proposals a week after the administration. The Obama administration came out with proposals similar, talking about systemic risk regulation. And there's going to be a great need for global coordination around all these proposals.
I think instead of talking about what the administration hasn't done, we probably ought to talk about what they have done. And I have a strongly dissenting view on this. First of all, what they haven't done is simply they haven't consolidated a lot of agencies. And I think they decided, along with many in Congress, that that would be too difficult politically to do. But what they have done is they have recommended that major companies, companies that they or someone might think might create instability if they fail, be regulated specially. And what that will do is it will designate certain companies as too big to fail. And when we do that, those companies will have substantial competitive advantages over others, just as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac did. We ought to avoid creating more Fannie Mae's and Freddie Mac's instead of authorizing them. Now, the whole question of regulation, I think, is fraught with questions, because this is the second time that major banking regulation has simply failed. There has been a lot of talk about the fact that there has been too much deregulation. But in the banking field, regulation has only gotten tighter. And when we look at the banking industry is the most heavily regulated industry we have, and it's in the most trouble. It is the one that we're most worried about. So I think we have to begin to, instead of a knee-jerk reaction, which is, well, these terrible things happened, let's increase the power of agencies in Washington, let's extend regulation into all other areas of finance, which is what the administration is proposing, we ought to think for a moment about whether it makes any sense at all. And from my perspective, it doesn't.
Okay, well, your surfacing points we'll come back to. So let me just table that for the moment. There are a few of these things I want to pick up and go into in more detail. But Roger, first of all, I'd be grateful for your overall take on the reform.
I agree with what I've generally heard here. I think Bob is absolutely right, which is the administration did what I would describe as the art of the possible. They focused in on two or three things that they think really must be done and where they believe they've got the votes to do it, I assume. I will come back to the systemic regulator issue because I think Peter and I disagree on that. But clearly, focused on consumer protection and investor protection is something that the country is crying out for. That was an important part of what they put forward. The issue of systemic regulation they put forward, and I think that was quite important. I do agree with Bob. There are a number of things that have been talked about for some time that they didn't touch. SEC and CFTC is one. They did not, unfortunately, in my judgment, put forth an optional federal regulator for insurance, which should have occurred. Again, I think that's relatively low-hanging fruit, but is going to attract some competition and some naysayers. So I think, broadly speaking, I give them a passing mark, but there's more that they could have done, and one hopes that this will emerge, as you've indicated, Beth, over the next couple of quarters. The place where I think I disagree with Peter is on the issue of systemic regulator. Unfortunately, the truth had been that there was sort of an implicit systemic regulatory oversight regime that was never explicit. And I think it's quite important to go from implicit to explicit on this issue. I think it's quite important for the country to finally stand up and say there are some institutions that are both large, interconnected, and complex, and they need sort of a special look. Because what the regulators had been doing before was sort of edging to that, but they never actually took the step. I agree with Peter, there's some risk associated with it for sure. And so it must be done well. If an institution becomes too large, interconnected, and complex, that is systemically important, they, I think, will have to get some more capital, for example, greater exposure on their risk management tools, more transparency. But in this crisis, I think it would be unwise for us, Peter, to step back from focusing on systemically important institutions. And I think it would be very important for us to give them a special kind of treatment.
Let's just talk a little bit more about this key issue, this too big to fail issue. Well, then we might come back to a couple of the other points that have been raised. Peter, maybe you could help people to understand your worry here. It's a moral hazard issue. Is that the main thing that's driving it?
Part of it, of course. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, I think most people here understand that problem. They're probably going to cost the taxpayers about $400 billion when they're all wrapped up. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were an example of moral hazard, example of the fact that People did not think there was any risk in making loans to them because the government would ultimately bail them out. That's what we're talking about when we make companies too big to fail. And that's what the suggestion is. If you say all the large insurance companies, the large securities firms, the large finance companies, hedge funds are all going to be too big to fail. We are creating Fannies and Freddies in every sector of our economy.
When you say, you know, we are making these companies too big to fail, is that quite right?
We are constituting them.
Successful companies make themselves too big to fail, unless you're going to argue, you know, that a bright line, you know, can be drawn where we say there will be no rescues. I mean, can the government credibly say that?
Absolutely, the government can say that for some institutions
of the size we're talking about?
I don't think there's any question about it.
Lehman
is a very good example of what happens if a company goes into bankruptcy. Lehman has been worked out in bankruptcy perfectly well. Now, there were problems after Lehman, as we know, but it was not because it was, it's actually a perfect example of moral hazard, because after Bear Stearns was saved in March, everyone expected that Lehman would be saved, and so people continued to deal with one another in the international capital markets. When Lehman wasn't saved, people said, uh-oh, we better find out the risks of everyone else we're dealing with, and that's when things came to a halt, the so-called second crisis. But in fact, if Bear Stearns hadn't been saved, people would have protected themselves against Lehman, and we wouldn't have had the kind of contraction that occurred right after it failed. But after it failed and went into bankruptcy, even though it was big and interconnected and all the other things that people say, it's been worked out perfectly well. They sold their investment management business, their investment banking business, and their broker-dealer business in 2 weeks after going into bankruptcy to four different buyers. So we ought to allow companies to fail.
Bankruptcy is sufficient to the...
It works perfectly well.
Let's hear some other views on this.
Let me just add one more thing. It does not work well for banks. Banks are very special. Banks are where people put their payrolls. They put the cash they expect to be able to use to buy food and pay mortgages. People don't put their payrolls with hedge funds or with securities firms.
And that distinction between banks and non-banks can still be made as strictly as is necessary for your purposes?
Absolutely, because no one else is able to offer a deposit or a liability that is withdrawable on demand. No one else can do that. And so banks are very special, and that's why we have always protected them. And that's why when they fail, they have to be treated differently from anyone else.
Okay.
Roger, what do you make of this?
I agree and disagree with Peter. I think obviously banks are special. That's right. We should be cautious. To say something systemically significant does not mean, in my judgment, that it's too big to fail. What we should, I think, aim for is a systemic approach for large interconnected institutions that does require, as I said, extra capital perhaps, different look at their risk management systems, further oversight without having the government really manage them, obviously. Too big to fail is a different issue. I think, as you observe, we should not create the environment of anything being too big to fail. The lesson from Lehman, in my judgment, is there are institutions that are too interconnected to fail over a weekend, not too interconnected to fail over a longer period of time. So we would expect a systemically important institution to have a wind-down plan that makes some sense. So I think you're right. Lehman ultimately got worked out, but we shouldn't underplay the disruption in markets that came from the sudden failure of Lehman Brothers, which did take people by surprise. Yeah. On Fannie and Freddie, I would say there were a number of policymakers, starting, I think, with Gary Gensler, in the Clinton administration, going through Bob Steele in the Bush administration, who were raising the alarms around Fannie and Freddie. Obviously, it did not get handled appropriately for a variety of reasons that I suppose books will be written about. But we shouldn't observe that Fannie and Freddie were unknown to regulators. To be fair, the interplay between and amongst regulators, the Treasury, the presidents, and Congress did not get them managed appropriately, one might argue, in hindsight, but I don't think we should say it was not noticed that they were getting to be very large and potentially risky.
I also think Fannie and Freddie are different and should be separated from the conversation. They're very unique organizations, and I think their business model is really in question and should be in question. They operate in the public interest, trying to promote a social good, if you will.
but for a private gain. And that creates in their business model an inherent conflict, but I think it's a very different discussion from too interconnected to fail.
I think we have to understand the principle here, and the principle is that Fannie and Freddie were able to drive all competition out of the fields that they were in because they were able to attract funds at a much lower rate than anyone else. And the reason they were able to attract those funds is because people assumed that the government was going to bail them out. And the people were right, despite the statements by the government year after year that that was not true. People just didn't believe the government.
You're just making this case. Their business model is
yes,
flawed.
But the fact that you are able to attract funds inexpensively in preference to any other person you are competing with is going to create companies like Fannie and Freddie in every area where we create these specially regulated firms.
Well, when we talk about systemic risk, I'd agree very much with Roger's point. I mean, that's not a guarantee you're going to get 100 cents on the dollar. Maybe you'll get something. You're talking about having an orderly workout, which I think is a perfectly reasonable thing to say. So there was always, obviously, people were looking at Bear Stearns and they were looking at Lehman with an expectation that they would be covered. So there's still there was uncertainty now, there'll be uncertainty in the future. There's not going to be a guarantee that you're going to be covered 100 cents on the dollar. I also just want to go back quickly to your point to saying that the banks are the most troubled sector. I'd say the investment banking sector was the most troubled sector, and that was very lightly regulated, as we all know.
You know, I think the problem was we outran our supply lines. I mean, it wasn't whether somebody's people were too big. I mean, everybody knew about Fannie and Freddie and everything. It was when you got down to the, it was like everybody was blind. You ever read the book by Jose Saragamo? Everybody goes blind in a whole town. And so if you just sit here and close your eyes and say, let's all go out the door, it'd be a mess, right? But the health systems break down, the food systems, transportation systems, everything breaks down. It's a very uncomfortable book, particularly if you wear glasses like I do. But that's kind of what happened in the financial markets, was we didn't have good enough infrastructure. So you didn't know who had all the CDS. You didn't know who it was. It wasn't cross-collect. You know, everything was messed up. And so when you're faced with making a decision over a weekend, I can totally understand and think that the Paulson group made in Bernanke made good decisions based on what they had because they didn't know. I think cleaning up the transparency and improving the infrastructure around this would go a long way to improving and stopping systemic risk. I don't think having one set of people who get together once a week, once a month, or once a quarter is going to stop systemic risk. I mean, I just, you know, they're not going to have, even if they, you know, everybody knew about Fannie and Freddie. I was part of groups for the last decade that have been raising their arms on Fannie and Freddie, and everybody knew about it, and nobody did anything about it. So I don't think having one group is going to make everything all right.
Peter, if I'm understanding him correctly, Peter is arguing that with the exception of deposit-taking banks, and you're defining banks very narrowly to, you know, confining the definition to deposit-taking institutions, with that sole exception, there's no such thing as systemic risk.
Well, first of all, we haven't defined systemic risk very well. And what everyone else here is kind of assuming, it seems to me, is that the government knows how to define systemic risk. But in fact, what we know is that the government wants to avoid disruption of any kind. There's no way to know whether the failure of a particular institution will cause systemic risk. I happen to believe that no institution that takes money on term, that is for periods of days, months, or years, as opposed to paying liabilities on demand, can actually create what we mostly consider to be systemic risk, and that is cascading losses through the economy. You know that you will suffer a loss when an insurance company fails, but you don't know how much of a loss that will be, and will occur sometime down the road. But with a bank, you suffer a loss immediately in the cash that you need. We haven't defined systemic risk, and if we give the government what everyone here seems to want, and that is the idea that they can take over these failing or troubled financial institutions and gradually work them down or rescue them the way we're doing with GM, again, a fear of disruption, what we are going to do is create a situation in which the taxpayers are going to be taxed again and again. We're putting in, probably in the end, $200 billion into AIG. My view is AIG could have failed and could have gone into bankruptcy, and the taxpayers would not have had to pay the $200 billion that they paid.
What do you make about of AIG? This is your industry. You're already uncomfortable because of your glasses. So let me ask you to make you even more uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't think you could have let AIG fail, because I don't think anybody knew exactly what the secondary and tertiary consequences would be. You didn't know, you know, if Goldman was in for $8 billion, you didn't know what the impact was. Nobody really knew where it was going to go. So I conceptually and philosophically agree that if someone messes up, they should be able to lose all the money. And the shareholders essentially got wiped out there. So, but I don't think you could have let it go under.
But let me distinguish, I'll let you answer, but just distinguish two instances. September 15th, I'd agree, you couldn't have let AIG go under. But the payments were actually made November, December, January. So suppose we at some subsequent point after the immediate fallout from the collapse of Lehman had decided, okay, we will let AIG go under. Would you still say that wasn't doable?
If you could tell, but I don't believe that in FP, financial products, which was the sub where all the problems was, they actually knew. But I'm not an insider there, so I don't know. I want to broaden it, though, for just a second, come back to this sort of, we're talking about systemic risk, companies, we talked about the regulatory structure, we need to do something different regulators. But I also think the administration's on something. I agree with Roger on consumers. But I don't think it should be a consumer financial protection agency. I think it should be, because that sounds like I'm protecting you from some bad guy. And believe it or not, most financial services people actually think they're doing a good thing in the world. And so I would call it the consumer financial participation agency. But there's a point here. They're after access. Totally agree. There's a whole bunch of people in the United States who don't have access to our financial system, and that so they can't live the American dream. But there's two parts. They have transparency, and I would break it into that. There's education and information, and I want to make a point on both of those. Education. I have a nephew who has Soto syndrome, which is like giganticism. Big, bright, wonderful kid, but he's not real smart. And so he came to Chicago, and he loves food, and we sent him to this restaurant, which has huge steaks, and I said, get the chocolate cake, because it's like this huge piece, and I know he loves desserts. And he came back, and I said, did you get it? And he said, no, I didn't know if we had enough money. And I take a calculator, but it's a solar calculator, and it didn't work in the dark restaurant. So we took him back, you know, I thought, okay, you don't really have to do this. But the point is, most consumers aren't that different from my nephew. 37% of Americans cannot calculate a 10% discount on their restaurant bill, even with the use of a calculator. So if we're going to have people participate in this system, we got to educate them. There's really no set of rules. So I think we should just let everybody go take classes at community colleges, give them a tax credit to do it immediately, and let them get educated, because we talk about, you know, teach them about, you know, if you can't get a 10% discount, you have no chance of figuring out whether you should do an adjustable rate mortgage or fixed rate mortgage or what kind of credit card. So I think we need to do education, and I think the administration missed that opportunity. And then there's information, which is, you know, we need to tell this stuff in a way in which people can understand it. But because of the litigation environment we're in, we don't tell it that way. And so we have these very complicated pieces of paper, which you can't tell. And so, for example, in insurance, there's a difference between a raccoon and a squirrel. If a raccoon gets in your house and messes it up, that's covered. If a squirrel gets in, it is not covered. The reason is because a raccoon is a member of the bear family, hence it is a wild animal. A squirrel, on the other hand, is a rodent. Okay, and we don't cover rats because we're not supposed to spread that cost across society. So we put that in a contract. This actually happened to me. I'm standing at a house I have, and there's a hole in the roof, and a guy says, is it a raccoon or a squirrel? I said, you know, I don't know. And had I answered squirrel, it would have been like, wrong answer. So we do this big contract. We do this big contract, and it confuses people. So I think if in new reforms, if we could say, give some safe harbor to companies, where if you actually lay it out in a way in which people, it's information, not data or contract stuff, it would go a long way. And then get people educated. I think we could get more people in the system. And I think that's another part of the problem. So, you know, we screwed up, regulators screwed up, but we also know a whole bunch of consumers made bad choices, some on purpose, some because they just didn't know. And I think we ought to address that issue.
I wanted to ask Beth about consumer protection. What do you make of that aspect of the issue?
I think the consumer protection
protection is an important element of what the president's proposed, but I got nervous as you kept drifting toward this, was drifting toward we need to educate our way out of this. I think leadership in business, there were some very bad business decisions made. Risks were built into the system through short-term compensation practices that rewarded aggressive risk-taking behavior. Transactions were accumulated, risks were, you know, securitized and sent off around the world. I mean, let's not go too far from where this problem, the heart of it lies. I don't frankly blame our regulators perhaps even as much. I mean, this lied at the heart of bad business decisions being made. And I think, Roger, just a point you made about the systemic risk regulation, I do believe that we need to look at the entities and the institutions that pose systemic risks differently. Once they're identified, once we figure out what a systemic risk, you know, institution is, what are the right corporate governance around those institutions? And should it be different than organizations that don't pose a systemic risk to the system? We peanut butter corporate governance equally. You know, boards need to look the same requirement. Everything about corporate governance for a systemically significant institution is the same as one that is not. And I think one of the lessons I think we've learned is that's probably not the right thing. The risks inherent in a systemically significant institution are very different, and they need to be focused on in different ways.
I got to tell you, if you look at businesses today, no, we made mistakes, but if you look at any financial institution today, you look at their risk management practices, and if you say, if it was a three before, what is it today? I guarantee you everybody will be a higher number. The businesses are working hard at figuring out how to improve the risk management stuff, waiting for Congress to come up with sort of what the risk management stuff are is a waste of time.
That's my point, but go ahead.
But let me agree with you, because there's a lot of wisdom, and I think we're creating false differences when, in fact, we'd all agree on a number of things. We'd all agree with your point about financial literacy. It's been a national shame. Your statistics are right. We need to do more. The basic news about financial literacy is what everybody's mother taught him or her, which is, if it sounds too good to be true, guess what? It probably is too good to be true. Okay? You could say it, but then you have to apply it. We also would absolutely agree that at the end of the day, this was a failure of top management and risk takers in the private sector for a variety of reasons. I would argue partially that risk management did not look as closely at these issues as it should. And I know that because I am president of a company that fortunately looked at subprime and said, we don't understand it, we don't want to invest in it, proving that indeed a large financial services company could take the step back from the subprime crisis and protect our participants and shareholders. My company's not going to get everything right, but I'm proud of the fact we got that one thing right when very few others did. So I would absolutely say a huge part of the blame belongs not on regulators who are always going to be late to the party, but very much on management and risk management.
Well, let me make the case.
I'm arguing that the third point I would make is part of the risk that we've got here is we put too much weight on the regulatory structure, et cetera. And I do think, with something that Beth didn't say, but I think she was heading towards, compensation has got to be structured across financial services to align behaviors with long-term interest of shareholders, policyholders in the case of insurance companies, et cetera. So the other thing that clearly failed here was, frankly, at the board level and at the CEO level and the HR level, creating compensation structures that had clawbacks, multi-year payouts, some risk-adjusted sense of the return, not just the nominal return. So there were a variety of things, I think, that failed. So I think there are lots of places of agreement.
But is that
here
a regulatory issue?
No, at the end of the day, we don't want the government to do anything other than to say you should have the right kinds of compensation structures, in my judgment. I think boards absolutely have an obligation to understand what that should look like and put that in place. After all, it's boards who are representative of the shareholders. The other thing that I think boards should do is to give shareholders what we call say on pay. Not the absolute number, but be very transparent about how it is the CEO is going to be compensated, how it is that some of the leading, you know, the top four or five people in executive management are going to be compensated, what those programs look like. Should be made much more transparent and give shareholders a chance to vote on those, yay or nay. But I think ultimately, if we wait for the government to do it, the government can't possibly determine what this should look like. board should have the obligation to do it on behalf of the shareholders, and the shareholders should have a say.
On a point of clarification, I'm still not quite sure what you're saying. On say on pay, do you think that should be a regulatory requirement, or are you merely urging boards to do it?
To be fair, I would argue that it should be a regulatory requirement. Okay. But having said that, again, looking from the standpoint of TI Cref, we as a shareholder have put that on to proxies, and this year we had three or four, I forget the exact number of companies, where we got 40% or more of the fellow shareholders vote for it. So without waiting for the government, shareholders themselves can demand this.
Sure.
But I think it would be better if the government took a step saying this looks to us as though it's a smart thing to do.
Dean, you wanted to come back. Have you lost the thread? Or?
No. Okay. I was going to jump in. I'd go beyond say your pay and say we should actually have rules of corporate governance that require that executive compensation packages get set out for shareholder approval at regular intervals. But that's a step further. But in any case, getting back to my point about why I'd say the regulators are so clearly responsible, people always call this a financial crisis, and I really think that's wrong, because we have a financial crisis, but it's very hard for me to see how anything would be different today if we could snap our fingers and have all our institutions completely solvent. We had huge imbalances in our economy created by the housing bubble. So we had the housing sector, which over the post-war period had been about 4% GDP, expand to over 6% GDP, enormous overbuilding. That was going to end. We also saw the savings rate go into negative territory. We had all these people running around, Pete Peterson and his crew, lecturing everyone, well, you have to save. Well, the housing wealth effect's pretty well established. It's about the most well-established thing I could think of in economics. So it wasn't surprising that when you had $8 trillion of housing bubble wealth, people would be spending like crazy. It's a totally rational thing to do. If your home just went up in value, $200,000, why shouldn't you take some of that money to buy a car? It's totally rational. It's only if you know that's going to disappear next year. That's a really stupid thing to do. So that was Alan Greenspan. That was the Fed's responsibility. And it was as big an error as you could possibly make. So that's why I'm saying we have to hold these people accountable. Because I frankly couldn't think. Maybe if we took a while, I could think of a bigger mistake than that. But it would take a while.
The people who have to be held accountable, it's Congress. You're not going to get the regulators. The regulators are responsible to Congress. And imagine, if you will, that in 2006, the Fed was going to exercise its authority to stop subprime lending. Well, what would have happened? Alan Greenspan would have been called up before a congressional committee, and they would have pointed their fingers at him, and they would have said, you are going to deny the American people part of the American dream here. This is what is giving people an opportunity to own homes, and it actually was, because you are trying to do some sort of control over this issue. That is the main problem. It's one of the problems with regulation is that it is pro-cyclical. And when things are going well, everyone loves it, including Congress. When things are going badly, as they are now, the regulators are down on the banks and telling them not to lend. Probably everyone in this room has had some sort of experience like that. We have to look at regulation as a solution. It is not a solution. It in fact causes as much in the way of problems as it purports to solve.
And I would have been American in 2002 before subprime took off, because that was when the bubble was already clearly visible and was already creating serious imbalances in the economy.
Sure, would have been a good time.
Let me just say what my problem with this line you're taking is, Dean, that holding regulators accountable. My problem with your view that it was obvious there was a housing bubble is that at the time it was not obvious. It was very much disputed. I mean, there were people pointing it out, but I think you'll agree they were in fact in a minority.
Yeah,
I mean, there was a torrent of commentary saying, you know, house prices have never fallen since the Great Depression, which was true, of course. People thought that meant it could never happen.
And it was a really foolish thing for them to think, and they should suffer consequences for being wrong. I mean, why we expect dishwashers, when they break the dishes, they get fired. You know, if you don't clean, the custodian doesn't clean the toilet, they get fired.
Yeah.
How come when economists are wrong, we just go, who could have known?
But the question is... What I'm asking is, what you want, presumably, is a deterrent that works. In other words, you sack people so that next time the same mistake won't be made. But in the same circumstances next time, even if you had put regulators' heads on pikes, that mistake will be made because it won't be obvious. In other words, it wasn't incompetence and it wasn't bad faith. It was a mistake.
Well, let's just think about
almost everybody made.
Let's just think about the incentives, though. The point is, here it is. You have Alan Greenspan, many of the top economists in the profession, saying that, you know, people like Dean Baker are nuts. Okay, so, you know, you could sit there and do your analysis, think it through independently, and maybe you'd come to agreement with me. Maybe not, but maybe you would. But you'd be taking a really big risk for your career. You're going to go out there with those nuts saying there's a bubble, or you're just going to go along, well, Greenspan, all these other people, yeah, that's fine. Well, the incentives are totally skewed right now. There is no risk for just going along and saying everything's fine. These people are paid good salaries. They're supposed to work for a living.
I honestly don't think you could say that Greenspan has got away scot-free. I mean, his reputation is trashed. You know, he has paid a price, I think. You know, a fair-minded person would agree he's paid a price. Well, Bernanke was not as deeply involved in these arrows as Greenspan was. But listen, just put this to one side. I just want to focus on this one thing, because I think, you know, with your animation over the issue of the housing bubble is as it were not the strongest argument you can make for holding regulators accountable, because I think there's a distinction to be made between the error over house prices can't fall and the mistakes that were made over permitting these extraordinary lending practices.
I actually disagree with you on that in the sense that in the absence of a housing bubble, none of these things would have been that big a deal. AIG having issued all these credit default swaps, well, the reason that became a disaster was they were betting that house prices in New York weren't correlated with house prices in Los Angeles.
In any state of the world, you should want a borrower to produce documents to verify income if that borrower is going to get a mortgage, shouldn't you?
It was a bad practice, but wouldn't have had disastrous consequences for the economy. It was only because house prices plummeted.
AIG wasn't only housing. There was a whole liquidity factor in there that shut down those markets. They put those prices way down. So I don't think you can blame AIG on housing.
Let me jump in and defend Dean, not that he needs defending, but agree with him on a point. Well, I disagree with him on, this was a failure of regulation, though regulators, I agree, were far from perfect. I would say there are clearly imbalances in the U.S. economy that have been building up for long periods of time that were much discussed by regulators here and around the world, because there also were global imbalances. So absolutely, you're right. Was there a housing bubble? I think you're right. The debate at the time was, there are housing markets that seem to be overheated. One could look at what one might describe as the sand states, Nevada, Florida, Southern California, think, well, that seems out of balance. But that's quite different from saying there's a national housing bubble that one has to deal with. Second point, so I agree on the housing bubble and imbalances. There are limitations to the ability of regulators to manage something that large as a macroeconomic imbalance with any of the tools that we have. You must recall that the Fed was starting to raise interest rates in 2004, going on, and predicting that they would be raised in an effort to maintain, overall stability. Failed success, history will judge, but obviously it's not as though people were ignoring the need to raise rates. On the regulatory structures, that's my second point. The third point is there's a real dilemma as a regulator. You see something going wrong. You think it could end badly. You're not sure. Do you go and say, I'm not sure this is going to end badly, but I am going to overrule management and take the responsibility for running your company for you against what you want to do? Or do you say, let me tell you, I'm worried about this. What do you think about it? And they come back and say, well, we think we've got it under control. And you say, well, I'm still worried. And you have a debate. So the reason I'm a little cautious about blaming regulators, it is impossible to hold regulators to better insight than any other human being. And we are not in a society in which we want the government, I think, to generally overrule private decision makers out of an instinct or an analysis that suggests something may go wrong but doesn't have a high degree of confidence around it.
If I could build off that, because that sets it up perfectly. Because, again, what I'd focus on here are what are the structure of the incentives for the regulator and exactly the story you described. We're never sure. So you have this scenario. You're looking over at AIG, whoever it might be, and you're uncomfortable. Okay, so you do as you say. You go over and you talk to the people there. I'm not comfortable with what you're doing. They say, well, we've looked it over. We've thought about it. We think it's okay. Okay, now what are your incentives? On the one hand, you go, okay, we'll go along with you. Now, it turns out it blows up. Now, you suffer no consequences for that. Now, on the other hand, if you're to say, no, AIG, I don't like what you're doing. I'm going to shut you guys down. Well, you know you pay consequences for that. So if we want to have regulators that are going to be in a position to do their job, we have to try and put some symmetry to those structures of incentives so that it's not always going to be the easiest thing just to go to AIG and say, it's okay.
It's a really good point, is when we look back, is the way you were just describing the issue is focused on an institution, an AIG, a Lehman, versus the flow of transactions around the world and where those were going, cross-border, cross-institution, cross-entity. And I think in hindsight what we see is the weight of the transaction and the risks of the collective transactions ran to places that when you looked at institution versus institution versus institution, you didn't necessarily see.
Correct about the incentives of regulators.
Sounds so surprised.
Because I come out with a completely different analysis of it, and that is that the objective of regulators is to prevent disruption. They're worried about creating disruption by closing things down, and they're worried if a company looks as though it is going to fail, that it will fail, and that will disrupt the economy, and they'll be blamed for that. Now, I have a general criticism of regulation. I don't think it works particularly well. We ought to be relying on creditors and the private markets to regulate because the regulators are subject to political control. But once we give the regulators the power to shut people down or to take over companies, they're going to use it because the incentives for them is not to be blamed for things happening badly. And as a result, that will create much more.
The opposite, of course. They couldn't go worse than they just did. No one's really gotten blamed.
Well, let me talk about why they went so badly here, because we always have bubbles. It's part of human nature. We are always going to be enthusiastic about things developing in the future. There are always explanations, as you were suggesting, for why this housing bubble was going up. But what people do not understand is that in this housing bubble, there is $4 trillion in subprime and non-prime lending. That's the key that made this housing bubble, when it deflated, the disaster that it has become. And so what we have to look at,
you go back to
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and you go back to the Community Reinvestment Act, which encouraged people, banks, to make commitments to lend, to do subprime lending. Over $4 trillion in such commitments were made between 1995 and 2008. Those commitments turned into the bad mortgages that have infused this bubble that we're worried about.
Okay.
So I think we have to look at this in a much broader picture. This is not simply a question of dealing with a problem that has arisen in the last 2 years. This is a problem that has been caused by government policy over many years.
For the boogeyman in this, because it's satisfying to be able to point to one person, and I think that the president said it the other day in describing this, where the current president said that this is where failures on Wall Street, Main Street, and in Washington. And I think to overly target it to one place, you're going to really miss the chance to make significant improvements, and it's a false simplicity. If I could go back, I would challenge Peter. I think he's a bit casual with some of his vocabulary, and this is a bit self-interested and declared so. I don't think the people at Bear Stearns consider themselves saved, quote unquote, and that was a decision that was made. I spent my life believing that securities firms were different and that they could fail and that that was the appropriate resolution for an unsuccessful business model in the securities industry. And I had a pretty good seat on this show, and I think that the considered view was that the effect on the overall economy by having a messy weekend failure, given the lack of any resolution authority with non-bank financial institutions, made this the right public policy decision. And you know, it's not, when you have a mess in the financial markets, it's really not about the people in my town with the long driveways. It's about the people who are at the edge of the financial system who really feel the repercussions much greater. And so the idea of protecting the market so you thought they could work and have time to work out, then that was the view. But I think saved has a connotation that I would challenge. from that perspective.
Okay. I'm going to, no, please, I want to take some questions from the audience. We've got quite a few here. People behind me are at a disadvantage. I'll stop. David, do you want to ask the first question?
Yeah, I see the administration's...
why don't you say who you are, then...
gone off balance sheet and set up independent vehicles. And the question I have is, did you know that at the time, and what were their warnings about the banks moving in this direction?
Well, I should, David and I should be quite transparent. We've known each other for years, and I'm not surprised at the question.
You still have to answer.
No, I mean, transparency is important. Now, to answer the question is yes and no. Let me
hold on. The question was basically, do you have confidence in the system,
yeah,
Fed in the future, that, you know, the Fed had lobbied for so many years to have, you know, oversight over the bank holding companies. Is the Fed up to it as
but,
a system?
But I mean, that's why I'm trying to answer the question. And it's sort of back to what Dean said.
Yeah.
The answer is what I would describe as yes and no. In the following sense, the Fed has deep staff, generally speaking, good leadership, exposure to markets more broadly. Under this plan, we'll have even more of that. I think we need an institution that has all those characteristics to take on this big responsibility. Having said that, I think you will always be in a case where human beings will have to exercise judgment based on incomplete information, models that may not work, because they've been historically accurate but may, in an important case, fail. And so we always have to be set up for the fact that no regulator is inherently going to get every judgment call right, which is why I very much agree with what I think I've heard a number of other people say, and I think you'd agree with it well, David, that the first line of defense is the market itself, counterparties, individuals, you know, the old rule, too good to be true, et cetera. We need to have that as the first line of defense. The government, I believe, is at best a second line of defense. The Fed, I think, is the best positioned, but I do not expect perfection, nor do you.
The question I have is just something as fundamental as, you know, setting up independent vehicles, which the impression was to obscure risk was that something that was relevant?
The SIVs obviously were, you know, one of the many points of failure here. To argue that SIVs were to obscure risk, I think, SIVs are basically off-balance sheet vehicles that banks owned. They used them for certain classes of investments and hold certain assets. The reason they created them was, I think, not to obscure risk, David, though one can agree or disagree on that point. It was much more a capital arbitrage question to get to a lower capital requirement than they would have if they held the same kinds of investments in their core balance sheet. And to be quite fair, one of the things that regulators have been struggling with for a long, long time is this question that is called capital arbitrage. Depending on where you book a risk and how you define it, you get either the bank would get either more or less capital associated with it. So I think the issue around SIVs and a number of other off-balance sheet vehicles was fundamentally one around capital arbitrage that the regulators have been trying to shut down for some time.
No, enough. We're getting very deep in the weeds, right, here. I can see one or two people wondering if they might just catch the end of another session instead. So let's move on. I want to take another question. You, sir. Just wait a minute. We'll get the microphone over.
Oh, okay. I think people could probably hear you, but there is a mic, so why don't you wait for the line.
Bill, it's a tiny city group. I overpaid it $4. Now, I have a question. $300 billion in troubled assets, which nobody, to my knowledge, has been able to value, less than $300 billion in Tier 1 and Tier 2 capital, a management which has been mediocre for decades. I have friends who say, send the controller's orders in, 300 billion, let's say it's 40 cents on the dollar, 180 billion is a bit more than the tier one and the tier two, have an orderly liquidation, the depositors get up to $100,000, and the assets are sold off, and you've just cleared out a large part of the uncertainty in America's banking system. I don't like that solution. But I have no way as a shareholder of valuing that $300 billion of assets. And I look to my regulators to help me out, and I have gotten no help, and I've gotten no sense of intelligent supervision of a difficult, troubled situation. It's muddled through with a lot of untransparency, and I'd like a little help.
Could I make a comment about that? I would say you should be thankful, and you should write a letter to the administration for the wealth they transferred to you with that guarantee. Okay? There was no value put on that thing. Nobody actually said how much money did we give Citigroup with that the guarantee of all those toxic assets. It's one thing to write a check and put whatever it was $40 billion in there. Those guarantees that they started putting on stuff are worth a ton of money. And I actually don't think that was right. I don't think you can go out and liquidate them today. We trade in those markets all the time. And I don't think Citigroup should try to liquidate them. But I think you should feel very happy that you got that because it's made that stock. If you overpaid it for, you still got something for free. I think that's a travesty. Nobody, and we never really accounted for how much money all this support was and how much wealth transfer we were doing to shareholders. And
they
I think
never listed the assets.
That's too big to fail.
Right. Yeah. But I have no transparency. Give me more transparency.
Yeah. There's no, I mean, that point's well taken.
Let me take a question from over here. Yes, please. We'll get the mic over.
I asked this question with the caveat it's not my area of expertise, which is a little scary in this room.
You're still allowed.
Well, what does the crowd think about that?
There is a thought that there has been substantial deregulation. There hasn't been. There has been in every area of the economy but for finance. And we are getting a lot of benefit from the deregulation that has occurred in transportation and airplanes and so forth. But in the financial area, regulation has been tightened. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation Improvement Act, which came in after the failure of the SNLs, was a very tight banking law. And everyone said at the time, this will end all banking problems because we are now subjecting them to serious, significant regulation. And of course, we now have the biggest banking crisis of all time. The Glass-Steagall Act, which many people have cited as an example of deregulation when it was changed by another act in 1999, has had absolutely no effect because banks were not able, after the Glass-Steagall Act, to engage in dealing or underwriting in securities. And all of the investment banks that got into trouble had no connection at all to commercial banks. They could have had a connection, but they never established such a connection. And the commercial banks that got into trouble doing what commercial banks do when they get into trouble. They made bad loans. So there hasn't been any suggestion anywhere that deregulation in any sense has caused this problem. It's a very simplistic way of approaching a very complicated problem.
Dean, I suspect you'd like to make that suggestion, wouldn't you?
I wouldn't say it alone caused the problem. Again, I keep harping on the bubble, you know, and we should have been going after that 2002, maybe even sooner. But, you know, that's when I first started talking about it. But I would say there had been important deregulation. For example, the relaxation of the leverage rules on the investment banks, which did have a very direct role in Lehman and Bear Stearns going under and the others being very much in jeopardy. Also, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, Act, which was a green light saying you can't regulate credit default swaps and other derivative instruments. So I think there has been very important deregulation. Again, other sectors of the economy, obviously, I think you've weakened unions seriously in the airline industry, in trucking industry, in many different industries with deregulation, which was in large part the point. So you lowered salaries in those sectors. But I would say more generally, my view on the financial sector is that the big problem has been that we have a really bloated financial sector because it's taken up a much, much larger share of the economy. It exceeded 30% of corporate profits at its peak in 2004. That's incredible for one sector of the economy. And you go, are we better served? Are we somehow more secure in our savings? Is it easier to do transactions today than was 25, 30 years ago when this financial sector was a much smaller share of the economy? I think you're kind of hard-pressed to make that case. So I would like to see the financial sector generally reined in. I mean, I've been talking about having financial transactions taxes. If you had very modest taxes like they have in England, just raise the cost of transactions back to where they were, say, 20, 25 years ago, you'd raise an enormous amount of money and, to my mind, bring the financial sector down to a more reasonable size. So those are directions I'd like to see us go.
Your question was, well, looked at regulation versus deregulation, was forward-looking, what can we do? There's a conversation that's not happening, and it hasn't happened in this discussion, and it's not happening generally, and let me just voice my opinion, it's provocative. But all the regulation or deregulation in the world, sometimes I don't even like to get into that, in that we know, research is so clear, that if you have a diversity of perspectives focused on solving a complex problem, if we put a diverse group of people around gender, ethnicity, et cetera, around this group focused on solving a complex problem, we would get to a better decision than a group of better qualified homogeneous individuals every time. And yet as a society, to your point, we don't embrace that value of diversity to produce better outcomes. So here we are having a regulation, deregulation debate, and yet one obvious thing that we could do without any regulation in the world is to improve and demand more diversity at decision-making tables, whether it's in boards, whether it's among our regulatory community, whatever. We know it would produce more innovation in a more risk-balanced way just because of the different perspectives brought to a problem. Yet that conversation actually isn't even bubbling at this time of economic crisis.
Interesting.
Can I come back to regulation?
Well, thanks. So Supreme Court confirmation.
We're a big believer in diversity, so I'm not trying to change it up. But there is one thing I think that's not being done, which is the difference between federal rules and state rules. And we haven't really talked about it. The current proposal is to create federal rules for financial services companies, whether it's CFPA or something else. And then to say the states can do anything they want as long as it's more onerous than that. And the concept behind the federal one is, well, we need some commonality and it's more efficient and more effective and that. And the concept behind the state one is, well, they're closer to the action or something so they can protect consumers. Well, it ought to be one or the other. Because when you create two, you create all kinds of inconsistencies in the marketplace. You create, it's really hard to work around those rules and you can't actually serve your customers the way you want to serve them. So for us to roll out a new product, takes us 3 years because we got to do it differently in every 50 states. Now, that's the world I live in. That's okay if that's the world I'm living. But now if I got to get the feds to approve it and I got to get the states to approve it, we're just going to go back. So I would say one of the things we need to do in regulatory reform is be clear about what the role the federal government plays and the state government is and eliminate the overlap because there's and the politicians don't want to deal with it. They're sort of like, you know, they want the state rights to be able to do whatever they want, and they still want Fed control. And that's an issue that nobody's addressing. And there's this recent Supreme Court decision which came out yesterday, which is going to make it even worse.
So I'll take another question, sir.
Where's the mic?
Shadow of the Valley.
Anyway, there's nothing you can do to stop them. I mean, I write back to my proxy, say executive compensation is excessive, and, you know, and now we have companies that, you know, lost billions of dollars to this company or this country, and but before they're out of there, you know, they have their parachutes and their, you know, the one that stands out is Merrill Lynch, and this guy has got away with Jesus. So anyway, I'm Republican, I'm anti-regular, you know, the smaller the better government. But I'm not sure what you can do about tying executive compensation to long-term performance, and I'd like to hear your comments on that. That's question number one. Question number two is really probably addressed to Bob. AIG, I mean, back three or four decades ago, AT&T got pretty big, and they were told to the baby bells were formed. Nothing bad happened. Nothing but, as far as I know, good happened. At what point does AIG get too big to fail? I mean, at what point does that get torn up? Wells Fargo is a huge bank, and all of a sudden now they have Wachovia. B of A was a huge bank, and now they got Washington Mutual, another huge. Same with Morgan Stanley. So I guess my final question is, what does it take to break one of these companies up to take them back to their core business?
Bob, do you want to take the second one first?
Well, I'll try, but other people here can comment too. I think there's, let me think for a second. I think that there's been and to disagree a bit, there's been much benefit to consumers and I think the story here, and this is a bit of a business schooly answer, but basically as technology has become a bigger part of the business model, that's a fixed cost. And basically, as you have a higher fixed cost, you can run more volume over it and offer products at lower prices. And there are certain businesses where I think scale, because of the nature of the fixed cost, allows consumers to benefit from a lower cost. And so I believe lots of industries are driven to scale. For example, pick one, credit card processing. That's a business that should be consolidated as opposed to distributed. And the beneficiary is consumers. As someone rolls products out across the country, you get the exact opposite positive effect of what Tom was just speaking of. When they want to roll out an insurance product, they have to get 50 approvals, and it costs the consumer. The loser in this insurance agent logjam in Congress by the insurance agents is the consumer. And I think the positive is when products can be rolled out easily and tested, and I think there's benefits to scale too. So my own view is that there's a reason why something like retail banking is a large business, and it's a benefit to consumers. And so, you know, so that's one thing on the other side. I do believe that that they're unattractive things, and you'll see the end for AIG, and it's not involving me. The government's now decided it'll be broken up into pieces as a strategy, and so I think that's the right answer too. But it's not all bad at scale, and so I think you just have to balance these things. You know, no one likes Walmart except for the prices, and so it's true. And you know, it's unattractive. It's big. They're do this, but people like to go there and shop. And so I think that's the balancing act in all of this, too.
This corporate governance issue on executive pay, Beth, do you have anything to add to that? We touched on it earlier, but...
I thought Roger stated it very well. I think on executive comp, you have to have the disclosure, so there has to be sunlight around what the compensation policies and structures are, and the SEC's just proposed some new rules on that. And then the say on pay, so you sort of need two things in my mind. You need disclosure so that people are aware, and then you need say on pay so shareholders have a voice. And when... If those two things work, then you can start to get things.
I'm not a fan of Sampay. I mean, while I have great respect for all of you, it doesn't tell you anything. I mean, we have 54 pages of compensation material, how our plans work. There's more detail. We got more summaries in our proxy. You can know everything you want to know about how I get paid or any of our top people get paid. When you have a say or pay, which is yay or nay, you don't know what it means. I mean, so I have an obligation to be talking to my shareholders all the time out saying, what do you think? Do you like this? And I'm always open to feedback and input. I'm just the actual vote through the proxy in a say on pay, what it really becomes is a vehicle for special interest groups to drive extra work. And I mean, I know that sounds like I'm being territorial, but it has nothing to do with that. I'm just, suppose I get a, we don't like it. Well, okay, what part don't you like? Do you don't like the size? Do you don't like the structure? Do you don't like the balance? These are complicated plans.
If you look at what's happened with executive compensation in the United States over the last 30 years, we've hugely departed from the rest of the world. You've just had an explosion in executive compensation here that you don't see in Europe, you don't see in Japan. You know, the CEO at Toyota and Honda, they get $2, $3, $4 million a year. They don't get what the guys who ran GM and Chrysler into the ground got. I think that indicates there's a real imbalance with the insiders really being able to control corporate, the corporations to the detriment of the shareholders.
But it's a conspiracy theory that it's all the people together fixing everybody's comp. How come the average life of a CEO is 4 years?
Because they make enough money in that time, they don't care.
So you think it's not. I will not. Let me do a couple of things. We have to distinguish the size of CEO comp from the structure. And people can think CEOs are appropriately paid, inappropriately paid. That's going to be a judgment call, and we'll go back and forth for a long time. I do think it's very important on the structure that there be a reasonable base salary, that there be variable comp, and I don't describe that as a bonus, but variable comp that is clearly tied to indications of performance over several years, yes. That there is a clawback provision, so you wait and see for long-tail activities, did it look as profitable at the end of 3 years as it did at the end of 1 year? Right? I think Tom would agree with that. All those things I think are important. But I appreciate the applause, The one that's complex, and I'm trying to be as thoughtful as I can here, is these so-called golden parachutes. Here's a picture to paint for you in your mind. A CEO candidate is highly sought after. He says, that's wonderful, or she says, that's wonderful. And then she says, I know that CEOs last maybe 4 years, maybe 5 years. At the end of that time, I'm going to be exhausted. My reputation could be completely trashed. I need something. Can you give me something at the end? And not the amount, but the concept. And I think that's the dilemma that boards are struggling with. We're trying to attract the best talent, male, female, black, white, whatever it may be. Talent does cost something in this country. And so I don't have the answer. I am not an enemy of golden parachutes, but I think shareholders have to understand that golden parachutes play an important role in attracting people. But the scale and size may, in some cases, have been unacceptable. I think that's part of what you're arguing. So there's no easy answer on this, but I do think there are two or three principles that we can all agree on and applaud.
One point on this subject, and that is I think we can all point anecdotally to cases that are abusive. But I think what the remarks, especially what Roger just said, suggests that what is true here is that we have a market. And if you want a particular executive, because he's got a good or she's got a good track record, you have to pay a lot to get that person. And as a result, we ought not to try to regulate something so that in all through our markets, especially in our financial markets, we're saying that you can't pay more than a certain amount. Because those talented executives, and I think some of them may be talented, are going to go to places where they're not regulated. And that will decrease the quality of the companies that operate in those fields.
Just for the record, I'm not talking about regulation. I'm just talking about changing the rules of corporate governance. We already have rules in corporate governance. I'm just talking about different rules.
I'll take there's time for a few more questions, but I want to inject one of my own, because there's an issue that Beth surfaced early on that we haven't come back to, and I think it would be a great shame if we slid past it, and that's the international dimension of this problem. One of my big worries with the Obama administration's proposal on financial reform was that this failure to consolidate the regulatory agencies is going to make it, in my view, much harder to have effective international coordination of these regulatory regimes going forward. I think that's a huge cost. I see there seems to be very little debate in the U.S. about this. Maybe this is a foreigner's perspective, but it seems to me so obvious that nothing we propose for the U.S. is going to work unless it conforms in a productive way to what other countries are doing on financial regulation. This is a global capital market. That element of the discussion so far seems to be almost completely missing. Any comment on that?
First, I'd agree with you fully that I'm not sure conform is quite right. The financial market is global. Financial institutions are global. Consequently, there has got to be an awareness of differences and similarities in regulatory structures around the world. I agree completely. Conforming is going to be very difficult because I believe, at least, that at the end of the day, regulators driven by parliaments want to create an environment in which their financial services sector can be as vibrant as possible because it creates wealth, creates better products, et cetera, et cetera. And I think you're going to find it very, very difficult in reality for all global regulators to agree across the board on everything because it's a complex question to ask them to do.
There's a middle way between, and by conform, I don't mean identical rules everywhere. I just mean an ability to communicate productively. I don't think we even have that.
I'm agreeing completely on that. Now, there are large numbers of committees that exist to do that. Some say they've failed, some say they've succeeded. But I think you're misstating slight. I think the internationalization of this is well understood in the Obama administration and globally. The challenge is getting to a place that is credible. But I don't dispute the general goal and direction.
I'm optimistic, consistent with Roger, that we need to figure out how we want this to work in our country first. And we're seen as an iconic fashion. And once we can organize our way, then other people will work with us and they can sync up in a better way. But there's a lot of domestic work to be done. And I don't think that's in conflict with being collaborative over time.
I just wonder if the collaboration shouldn't be up front in this process rather than an afterthought.
My hunch is that right now that we've got enough kind of things on our own plate to focus on, and this is very domestic. You know, the politics of why we don't have an optional federal charter proposal, why we don't have a proposal on CFT-SEC combination. These are domestic policy politics,
right.
As opposed to big global issues.
The one area, though, that having the U.S. think first puts us in a disadvantage, I think, is one, the G20 is very clear about the need for one single global accounting standards. That will be the non-U.S. result. And so when the U.S. thinks first, we're kind of in a ping-pong match between the U.S. and Europe.
Right.
Let me take another. Oh, I'm sorry, Peter. Yeah.
I just wanted to put in one thought here, and that is, again, when we work with governments trying to compose the sovereignty question, what you want to do with the people within your own country, and the difficult political questions that arise there, we ought to be thinking a little bit outside the box. I know it's hard for people to do, but the people who have an interest in controlling risk-taking are creditors. Creditors are the ones who get no advantage from risk-taking. And so what we ought to be doing is trying to be sure that there is enough transparency and disclosure about risk-taking in companies, not regulating them necessarily with examiners coming in and looking at their documents, but making sure all kinds of companies in the financial field are disclosing information that creditors can use to decide whether there is excessive risk-taking occurring here. And when it happens, then the creditors will withdraw their support. The companies will have to pay more in interest. They will not profit as much, and that will be the kind of discipline that really works. But if we're waiting for the governments to do all of this, it's hopeless.
So, Peter, would that mean more regulation of private equity and hedge funds?
No.
I mean, disclosure requirements, I'm sorry.
I think what we consistently is that there has to be a certain kind of disclosure. And analysts can, in fact, help develop the metrics for risk disclosure. But to wait for the government and wait for the agencies to do this, I don't think it'll work.
People are voting with their feet. I think we've come to the end of the session. Thank you very much.